most of you haven't read Finnegan's Wake, I imagine, right? Nobody knows. Well, take a look at it. You can't read the book. You can't read it. There's not one complete anything in there. But there are fragments, and you can read for a few seconds and pretend you're seeing something. But Joyce even frustrates that. He puts 60 to 100 languages in there on one page. So you look for English in there. Okay. So you don't know Finnegan's Wake. But you have to do your homework eventually and understand that McLuhan spent his life, when he was writing books, redoing Finnegan's Wake. Okay? He was redoing the methods. But he had the advantage of later, of being at the end of technological evolution with the TV, computer, and satellite, and he looked back and he see Joyce was a reflex responding to radio. And the rest of them were. So then he could say, well, I'm not going to talk about the cultural products of radio, study the cultural products. I'm going to study the sensibility of radio and how it formed cubism and all the arts in different cultures with their particular bias and the general bias of art as a category in Western culture. So he looked at the medium cut. So people run around worrying about Big Brother conditioning us. McLuhan could see that the Big Brother top-down conditioning was happening in media. But it was something that people naturally sweat in because you create a new environment. People are going to swim in it because they're going to learn from it. So that's why he said Orwell described 1900, at best 1934. So McLuhan said he was going to create a distraction on the sidelines to distract the triggermen. That would be the assassins, the Big Brother guys. And what's the rest of it? Stimulate the somnambulists to wake up the somnambulists, I think it was. So distract the bureaucrats, and yet the population swimming around the TV computer environment, he's going to try to wake them up. So he had two media he had to work at. That's why Don Thiel thinks he was schizophrenic. Don doesn't realize he wasn't schizophrenic. He was just operating with many audiences. And you had to put on a different medium, a different approach. That's formal causality, studying the audience, figuring out how you want to shape the audience, how you want to respond to their bias. Formal causality was his principle, so he would be different people in relation to different media. So when you're writing a book, he knows books are dead as a medium that's shaping people, but he always said the best book was Finnegan's Wake. So I'm going to explain Finnegan's Wake and update it. So I've written an essay where it's called Literary/Aesthetic Cliché Probes in the American Classroom Without Walls. McLuhan's favorite word for the TV world was classroom without walls. American culture, which contains all the media. America produced a lot of these media and cultural content. So they're the content of the global classroom. So how would you write a book? What would book culture produce after McLuhan? So McLuhan dies in 1980. The first person to have the McLuhan awareness and get his books published and continue what's called the Toronto School of Media Ecology was Barrington Nevin. So he put out some very good books in the early 80s. He was qualified to do it because he understood Finnegan's Wake as Marshall did. Not any Joyce scholar understood McLuhan like Eric, his son, and Barry Nevin did. So Barry rode with that. And so I say that's the first replay of McLuhan's School of Media Ecology after he died. It's a holeopathic retrieval. He's a hologram, a real thing, emphasizing the book medium. So the first one is Barry Nevin, replaying the Toronto School of Media Ecology. The next one, a couple of years later, is the New York School of Media Ecology. And that's what's called semiotext. A professor at Columbia named Silvère Latrunje, he started putting out French thinkers, Baudrillard, Deleuze and Guattari, Lyotard, Foucault, and there's another one there, I can't remember.
Virilio,
right. Those five. They swamped the Pages bookstore in the early 80s and middle 80s. They became very popular, and the hip culture was into them, and eventually they became established as academic people in the academic books and required curriculum in universities. But Silvère took the risk of bringing these people over, and I don't know if Silvère knew it. I know Silvère. We've discussed a little bit of this stuff, but every one of those guys was a student of McLuhan. Virilio had met McLuhan. Foucault was always being urged to meet McLuhan, but he refused to. Deleuze and Guattari talk about McLuhan, and Derrida and Baudrillard admits he was McLuhanite. Baudrillard's first published work is a review of McLuhan's Mediumism and Massage in 67. So the point is, you now have another replay of McLuhan out of New York City. So I call it the New York School of Media Ecology. The next one, I should say this. Barrington Nevitt, this place was called the Center for Culture and Technology. Barry said, okay.
Still is.
Is it still?
Yeah.
Okay. Barry, would, as an engineer, Barry Nevitt was an engineer, he emphasized cultural products like Finnegan's Wake to satirize technological developments. The New York School did the reverse. Foucault and these guys would emphasize technological developments and show how the cultural products reflected that. So they took the opposite tack. But the third school of Mediacology came out of Concordia University in Montreal, the Montreal School of Mediacology, around Arthur Croker. Now, Arthur Croker satirized the Toronto School of Mediacology. He had met Barry Nevitt. Barry used to speak a lot in Concordia in the early 80s. And he satirized the New York School of Mediacology. He realized, rather than get stuck in a dialectic between culture and technology, he realized that technology and culture had merged and come alive. That technology had taken on a life of its own. Now, there's an obscure quote in War and Peace in the Global Village we have up on our website, where McLuhan says, people do not realize that our electric environments are organic in the fullest sense. McLuhan said media were alive. If you want to take that dialectic and make an emphasis, that technology under electric conditions had become organic. So Croker knew that. He, being a Canadian, was better than the New Yorker. And Barry Nevitt was, how will I say this, replaying McLuhan literally, and was not aware of the newer media that the younger Generation X kids were dealing with, and those were Croker's students. So being a younger professor, he's in touch with the later media, so he has to come up with a newer language. So that's I would compliment him for getting past Barry and getting past New York. Now, the fourth school of Mediacology I call the diasporic school, and that is people who were students, or most of them were students of McLuhan, very involved with McLuhan, and they scattered around the world. One of them stayed here in Toronto, but one of them is Bob Logan, right there. He's a member, in my terms, of the diasporic school. You have William Irwin Thompson, Bruce Powell, Derek, and Neil Postman, all very involved in McLuhan. But their angle is, they being essentially POBs, print-oriented bastards, and literate academics, they saw the meaning of McLuhan's warning about literate culture. And these guys are all academics. Bruce Powell still trying to be an academic. He does teach, but he wasn't an academic when he was first influenced. He tried to become a novelist. But the point is, these guys love books, and they're worried about book culture, and they know McLuhan's warning. They understand enough about McLuhan as a serious warning, and they still want to wake up the values, the humanist values of individualism, creativity, freedom, what we call artistic thinking, and making the population be smarter in literate terms. Walked a nervous line. They would do their books, but in their books say, you know, this book, they'd be almost like, well, this book is expendable, we're going to try to warn you, but we could, with the computer, make people more literate and read more. So the diasporic school, in a way, as Neil Postman is classified, is a neoconservative Mediacology. He's neoconservative, not politically, he's a liberal anarchist, but in media terms, he's for preserving 18th century literate values. So diasporic school is the guys who nervously try to keep book culture going and try to maybe stop the torrent of images and celebrate McLuhan's preservation of literate values. They'll celebrate McLuhan as a bookman, because there was a bumper sticker went around the city saying McLuhan reads books, because everybody thought in the popular McLuhan was putting down books and was watching TV like a coach potato all the time. But nobody understood Finnegan's Wake, so what do you expect, right?
We should point out, though, he only read every other page.
That's right. Well, he was a double agent, a triple agent in all levels.
So he literally read every other page.
And so do you.
I don't know if I do.
We're
capable of reading
agent.
Every page.
What?
I don't read every page.
That's right.
Good ones.
Yeah, he read every other page only in serious academic books. He read every book, every page, every word in Pulp Fiction and non-serious
Mysteries,
books.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. He read every word.
That was entertaining.
because he said the serious books tended to be redundant. They always repeat themselves because they probably had some complex academic concept that they had to keep referring to. But that's actually what print is a ditto device. He said it repeats itself. So if someone's really into book culture, they'll write seriously and repeat themselves. But Pulp Fiction is actually people, like Mickey Spillane, they write books just to get money so they can go to movies and TV, and they ain't teaching kids their literate values. So Pulp Fiction is guys just faking books, and those are more interesting from McLuhan's point of view, right? And also, they don't repeat themselves because they don't have book sensibility, really. They're writing books so they can be made into movies. So that's the fourth school of media ecology. And so Nevitt got his books out first. And I'm saying these people, these schools, because these are people who studied McLuhan and understood him to a great degree. So they're qualified to be a replay of the school of media ecology. So you have the Toronto School with Barry Nevitt. Then you have Semitex comes out in the early, middle 80s. Then Croker gets his books out in the late 80s. Bob and de Kerckhoff get books out in the late 80s. You just get one out in the 80s, the alphabet.
Right.
And Powell gets a few books out, and...
So I forget, 95?
No, that's later. We're coming up there. I'm just talking about before 1990.
Maybe I'll make it into the 50s.
Yeah. And Derek gets one book out, and Thompson gets a couple of books out. Just for the record, that Conrad Black was lobbying for William Irwin Thompson to take over the center and oust Derek in the early, in 83, 84. Derek told me that. So what, you were going to say something about?
Well, I just wanted to... be able to catch your breath.
No, I don't know.
There are a couple of ideas that resonated with me. The idea that electric media is an organism.
Yeah.
The electric media recalls oral culture. And I'm working now on trying to understand the origin of spoken language. And there's a fellow by the name of Morten Christensen who came up with the hypothesis in 1994 that language is an organism which evolves in order to be easily learned by children.
Right.
And that therefore you can get rid of Chomsky.
Right.
Which is something that's desirable, well, you know, as far that's as I'm concerned.
But Robert, in McLuhan's thesis, the grammarian's point, he says that they're the ones who understood that language was a living organism. That was the grammarian tradition. The dialecticians got too abstract and missed that point. Mm-hmm. Therefore, they became nominalistic and thought that you could casually name something anything. They didn't know that the name for something came out of that object. It was intimately linked with it. That was the living rhetorical grammatical tradition, whereas the nominalist had a bit of a visual bias, would split the name off from the object and think that you could put any name in there, not knowing that the name had to resonate with the characteristics of the object. So that's where I see your point. But they knew that. McLuhan knew that historically. Now, I'm saying that organism is really tactile. Now, Marshall said language is tactile. We don't want to just emphasize the ear. A living organism is cohering all the sensory input and making coherent consciousness. So it's all the inputs. And the word for all that interplay is tactility, right?
That's what Merlin Donald said in a book called The Origin of the Modern Mind.
Right. He's an academic here. A friend's been telling me about him.
Queens,
right, but he's very popular right now, isn't
he? That's close enough.
Yeah. Well, I said here, Canada, I guess.
Yeah, right.
He's in moving into McLuhan areas unconsciously, isn't he?
Yeah, well, we book bastards sometimes are useful, aren't we?
Yeah. Well, I praise you in the... I say that you guys do point out the rich values and create rich books within that motive and agenda.
But in The Origin of the Modern Mind, what Merlin Donald says is that it was through mimetic communication, that is... facial gesture,
right.
Hand signals, vocalization, not verbalization, but just
right.
Vocalization and body language, that was the first language. It had intentionality and it's your tactile resonance.
That's the tactile ESP. And McLuhan has on page 23 of Counterblast that he's doing the content thing, like the content of TV is movies, the content of movies is novels, the content of books is speech. And either it's a question or a statement. Content of speech is what? He says, nonverbal mental dance, comma, ESP. He always had it first. He's always there first. But
yeah.
He got that from Joyce. From Finney's Wake is a book of ESP. You got to have ESP to figure out what he really meant. But he's showing the dance of cognition, the drama of cognition, and the nonverbal mental dance. And mental is gestural.
Right.
We don't know. Primitive man didn't know where the mind was. You know what I mean? They didn't locate in the skull. I mean, we know that later cultures thought it was breath. That's where their consciousness was.
But
that's
even in the thesis, he covers this.
Covers
PhD thesis about the gesture.
Oh yeah, that's very
very basic.
Yeah,
in the beginning was the word, and